Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with us today is Mark Mustjen, the author of the novels The Return and the, how do you pronounce the second one?
Gendarme.
And the book that we are talking about today, which is Boys with Wings. Now, The Gendarme was an international bestseller that has been published in 11 languages, and Mark was a finalist for the Dayton International Literary Peace Prize, interested in what that is, and shortlisted for the Saroyan International Award for Writing, and the winner of the Florida Gold Book Award for Fiction. He's the founder and president of the Word of South Festival of Literature and Music in Tallahassee, Florida, now in its 10th year. Mark's a former elected official and attorney and lives in Florida and Michigan with his wife and elderly dog. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Monica.
So let's start with what is the Dayton International Literary Peace Prize?
Well, they've changed the name of it a little bit, but it's still the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, and it's designed to honor books that sort of contribute to world peace. And so I was fortunate enough to have been nominated and shortlisted for The Gendarme, which is a book about the Armenian Genocide, a novel, I should say, about the Armenian Genocide.
Wow. You know, I didn't know anything about the Armenian Genocide until I read a novel. And that was, I'm trying to remember the name of it. It was a very kind of a famous book that...
Maybe The Black Dog of Fate?
No. It was the one about, actually about a transgender person, too. It was like a brother-sister that got married and then had a child that was... Hermaphrodite, I think.
And, okay.
Yeah.
No,
you're not familiar with that one.
I don't
okay.
think so. Yeah.
So what drew you to write about that?
Well, my heritage is, you know, is Armenian way back. And so I never knew much about it. And I ended up reading this book, Black Dog of Fate, and it got me sort of going on that. And so I did a lot of research and, you know, ended up writing the book. It took like 7 years. So, but I was glad to get it published. It ended up being published in a number of languages and doing quite well.
It's interesting how much you really can learn from a novel, isn't it?
Well, no question. And particularly if you write, you know, historical fiction, like I've done in The Gendarme and in Boy with Wings. And so as an author, I mean, if you're writing historical fiction, you want to get it right, the history part. And so I enjoy reading them, and, you know, because you can learn something as well as being entertained and maybe made to think.
So Boy with Wings is set in the Deep South in the 1930s primarily.
Yes.
Yes. And how much research did you have to do for that?
Well, a fair amount. I mean, again, some research was just on the time period. I mean, I wanted to get some of the language correct, the use of terms correct. But then a lot of research about circuses and sideshows and freak shows and sort of, you know, how they came about and when was their heyday and, you know, when did they, you know, sort of start to travel and stuff like that. And then what was it like for the performers and people that were part of those shows? So that was very interesting. And there are a lot of, a lot of the circuses wintered in Florida where I live. So I was able to do some research here in my own state.
How did you, I'm just wondering how much was actually written about that, that you were able to find that information about the freak shows in particular?
Well, more than you might think. You know, some of the best, information I got was just about researching freaks and human oddities and how have they been treated through the history and, you know, dating back to the Greeks and Romans and then through the whole Victorian age and Ringling Brothers and all that. So there's a fair amount of information there. And then there's also, again, some of the Florida-based stuff. There's some documentaries about, you know, sort of human oddities that appeared in sideshows. And then there's one memoir by this guy who ran these type of shows for 50 years named Ward Hall, and that was very interesting and informative as well.
Oh, I bet. Was it hard to find a copy of that?
No, it was published maybe 10 or 15 years ago, and so and he's a legend. He was something else. And you know, one of the things I learned about those shows was that a lot of them were a mixture of sort of fakery and real stuff. Mm. And so, for instance, they would have, you know, these bottled jars of, you know, what were purported to be human fetuses that were really pieces of twisted sponge. And then have true, you know, human oddities, the man with the hair all over, the bearded lady, the giant, that sort of stuff. But Ward had indicated that his experience was that people, didn't mind being conned as long as there was a little bit of humor or intelligence in it. And so I thought that was kind of interesting.
So the protagonist of Boy with Wings is the boy with wings who has. Do you want to describe what that means?
Well, yeah. So the story is a boy that. It starts out in the late 1920s that has, you know, he's born, and he has these strange things on his back. And so, that produces a lot of conflict and other stuff. And he ends up in this show, this freak show, traveling the South in the 1930s. And so, so the book is, you know, it touches on issues of race and religion that are still issues today. And, but more than anything, of what it's like to be different. That's a piece I tried to, touch in terms of creating the character Johnny, who's the boy with wings.
What drew you to want to write about people who are so different? What was it about that, you know, the story is, it was very gripping, but also kind of disturbing at times.
Yeah, you know, people have asked me, say, all right, well, let me get this straight, Mark. So you're a white male born in this country at this time period to parents who loved you and paid for your education. What do you know about being different? I tried to reach the place that I think everybody knows at some level of being on the outside looking in. And for me, it was middle school. You know, I remember I didn't have older brothers and sisters, so I didn't know what was cool. And I was, wore clothes that were nerdy. And I remember being ostracized and ridiculed. And, as small as that is, it still affected my life. And so that was, what I wanted to sort of reach out towards in this book.
Mm-hmm. Now, was the character of Johnny, was he based on any real person?
No, not exactly. I did a lot of research about human oddities, and there's all sorts. But as part of that, and in terms of the appearances I'm doing for the book, I wanted to try and find a current sideshow performer that might appear for me and just let me ask him or her about their life. What is it like to be up on stage and have people stare at you and pay to do it. And so I found this guy, and he and I are going to appear in a couple of appearances in the next month or two. And he has no legs. He walks on his hands. And I asked him in the course of this, I said, what is it like being on stage? Do you like it? And he goes, yeah, I love it. It's one of the best parts of my life. And so I think that was the experience for some human oddities, that they were kept at home, hidden away. Their parents were embarrassed by them. And suddenly they're put on the show and they're sort of the star to some extent. And so I tried to capture a little of that in Johnny's experience in the book as well.
Right. When he had a lot of ups and downs in his life, a lot of struggles, but the show was maybe one of the better times for him.
Yeah, I think at least initially. Yeah. So again, it's just I was trying to imagine what would it be like for a kid to be sort of thrust on that. And I could read some of these, descriptions of real true life freaks. There's a great nonfiction book called True Vine It's the story of these two boys who were albino African-Americans and were put, you know, sold to the circus, basically, and just sort of what their life was like. And again, they sort of liked being on the circus to some degree. They missed it when their mother finally got them and took them off.
Well, one thing is they're not the only odd ones there either. There's other people who kind of understand what it's like to be different.
Yes, and also some rivalry that, you know, so a lot of these shows had, and Boy with Wings, the show has a mixture of sort of human oddities and then what are called working acts. I mean, the guy who's breathing fire, the guy who's swallowing swords, the guy who's throwing knives, you know, who those guys were out there every day, you know, 10 times a day doing their stuff. And the human oddity comes out and shows themselves and that's it. And so I think there was some tension, you know, between, you know, those two, you know, types of acts in these shows.
Right, right. Now, another setting near the beginning of the book is the camp.
Yes.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about that and, you know, how you learned about that, how those, it was, they were getting sap from trees for, was it for rubber? I wasn't quite
clear.
Yes,
well, it was something to turn into turpentine.
Okay.
Yeah, so these were, and they were, I remember as a boy seeing, you know, these, you know, sort of turpentine trees, you know, that were tapped for the sap, if you will. And, you know, and there were whole, you know, just stands of trees. And this is what they did rather than raise, you know, other crops that they, you know, they took this from the trees, boiled it up, sold it to, you know, to be sort of, you know, used, it was used in shipbuilding and that sort of stuff. It was a fairly big industry in the South for, you know, probably 40 or 50 years. And there's actually a museum in Florida that covers a lot of this, you know, the story of these camps. And I did, again, research about what were they really like, what kind of tools did they use, how did they do this, what you know, how were the camps run? And so it was all, you know, a fairly interesting research to me.
And that was where you first sort of deal with the issue of racism, because Johnny finds, as a white orphan, basically finds himself taken in to a camp of African Americans. And
right.
Were there, you know, white tree, what do you call them? Tree men, tree.
Well, there were not a lot. I mean, I think most of the workers in these camps were African Americans. And, you know, and it was a, you know, I sort of described it, and I think it accurately, as one step above slavery, that these, you know, these were folks that had been freed, but now they're sort of indentured to the camp. And you have to, you know, buy everything from the commissary, and, you know, you can never quite earn enough scrip to get out of debt to the commissary. And so you're just sort of, you know, chained to the land, more or less. And so that was, you know, that was part of the, you know, description of that that particular part of the story.
And did the camps move around to different sets of trees?
Yeah, I think a lot of them, you know, they sort of had, you know, different sets within a geographic area. So they work this set, then they go work another set, then they work another. They're sort of taken by horse and wagon, you know, around. And so, and then, so I think they stayed in the same place roughly, but instead of like, you know, sort of like, you know, it wasn't like migrant farming or stuff like that necessarily.
Okay. So, and then you mentioned also that you deal with religion. And how does religion show up in the Boy with Wings?
Well, so the, you know, the way the book is structured, which is a little unusual, I guess, but it was by design, and I tried it different ways, and so the Johnny's parts of the book are told in sort of a close third person point of view, and there are a number of other characters who give a first person account, and I wanted them to sort of be reacting to Johnny. Because, you know, again, if you look back at history and how human oddities have been viewed or dealt with, in some respects, they're treated as a deity. I mean, here's something we don't understand. You know, what is this? This is something that clearly is otherworldly to some degree. And then often they're scorned and treated poorly. Said, well, these people are different. You know, they're not like us. We need to, you know, and the Spartans used to leave them out to die. And the Romans, you know, the creators of the circus, you know, played with them, you know. And so there's all sorts of reactions to people that are just different. And there's a religious aspect of that, I think. You know, the first book that I wrote was The Return, was about a woman who claimed to be Christ returned. And some of those same issues are at play here. Well, how would you know? You know, if this, you know, is this boy an angel? Is he a devil? I mean, how would, you know, what would tell you one way or the other on that? And that all, you know, sort of factored into it.
How did Johnny stay basically a good person with everything he went through?
Well, I guess it's the same could be asked for anybody who's been through a lot of hardship. The one thing I tried to do in the book was, you know, and I've tried to do it in all my books, is treat characters as real characters. And I find sometimes that if for white Southern writers, when they create, you know, African-American characters, they're often perfect people. You know, they have no flaws. They're the good guys. And I wanted my characters to be real. And so some, you know, the African-American characters have flaws. I mean, the woman who's, you know, sort of the grandmother of the camp and teaches the kids and all that, you know, she's a wonderful person, but there's a certain amount of anger that's there as well. And with Johnny, you know, I mean, you know, somebody who's really been through a lot, some really hard times, you know, there's a, you know, he gets angry to some degree. And acts out to some degree. And so again, you know, hopefully the reader would see them as well as being, you know, just real people.
Right, right. Now there was one character near the end that seemed almost a little supernatural. The aunt, what was her name? Aunt
Tilda.
Tilda. Was that intentional that you were kind of like, how did she know these things?
Well, in a way. So by that part of the book, you know, there really is. I mean, Johnny, I mean, his wings are sort of operational to some degree here. And so he's, you know, he's trying to experience, you know, a whole bunch of different stuff. And she saves him to some degree. I mean, he's wounded and sort of nurses him back to health. But I, you know, she had a little bit of a, if not ulterior motive, a motive, you know? And so again, it sort of got, you know, it was a little bit of the, she's African-American. And so there's sort of a, hey, you know, she tells Johnny, I want you to be a fighter man and do stuff, not just talk about it. And so again, that was, you know, that there's a, you know, spiritual part to that. And I don't know that it was intentionally, you know, super spiritual on creating that character, but she's an interesting character. I tried to make her something more than just a stock, you know, root doctor type person.
Right, right. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Mark Muschin, author of Boy with Wings. Do you have kind of a favorite character in the book other than Johnny?
Well, I don't know if it's favorite, but I he's a very dark character, so it's hard to, you know, this is going to sound bizarre that my favorite character was the killer, you know, but I think the character of Warren is just an interesting, multifaceted character. I mean, he is a bad guy, but I, you know, trying to give some background about how he got to be the way he is, and he's sort of a equal opportunity guy in his badness, if you will. And so again, I you know, he's a racist, he's a otherwise, but I tried to make him a real character. And I certainly know people that have certain aspects of Warren's, you know, personality that filtered into that.
Well, Warren isn't as bad as Doyle.
Yeah, well, true. Neck and neck. But sometimes, you know, if you think about books like, I don't know, that is sometimes the bad guy is what's the riveting part of the book. You know, the Silence of the Lambs. I mean, you know, that's, you know, Hannibal was what, you know, what drew people to the book. And so I didn't intentionally structure this that way, but I think interesting bad guys make for a great book.
Why do you think people are drawn to the weird? You know, to like, why did all these people were willing to pay extra money to see somebody who was weird or odd?
Well, it's a great question. So I read this book that was this whole sort of, the title of the book is a non-fiction book called Freaks. And it was all sort of a psychoanalytical thing about exactly this question. What is it about freaks? Why are we attracted to them? And some of it was fascinating. Some of it got way, way off, you know, down rabbit holes. And I'm like, I'm not sure about that. But for instance, one thing this guy said, well, you know, when you're a child, everyone's a giant. Okay. That's how you come into the world. You're dealing with giants. And so, I've never really thought about that, but it's true to some degree. But I think the overall, you know, sort of fascination with freaks is maybe, you know, it's a little bit like the overused car crash example that people, you know, really don't want to see, but can't help but look.
Right.
So I think people are, you know, if you're a farmer and you're in the 1930s and you're spending all day in a field behind a mule, and suddenly here's this thing to go to, and it's all strange and weird, and it's exciting to some degree. It brings some excitement to what otherwise may be a not an exciting life. And so I think, Monica, it's probably that as much as anything.
Did you, in your research, did you find that these traveling shows would run into problems with the law or in towns that they went to? Were they chased out sometimes?
Well, yes. And I tried to present, you know, the book presents several different examples of that. But
right.
But if you saw the movie The Greatest Showman and the Ringling, you know, it was all about the Ringling, the Barnum and Bailey show, and you saw some of that in the movie. I mean, that was, you know, people were, religious people or otherwise were against these shows. You know, what is this? Why are you doing this?
Mm, yeah. I imagine it was very difficult for these shows to survive during the Depression, which is what was, you know, the time period when you're writing about this, because nobody had any money to spend on things like that. And so is that what kind of brought them to an end?
Yeah, I think so. Also maybe some changing mores of the, you know, I did an interview the other day and people, the interviewer said, well, there really aren't any sideshows anymore. I'm like, well, yeah, there actually are a few, not many. But you can, you know, everything's on the internet now. So I think that you know, in some respects, you know, a tattooed lady, it wasn't really a, you know, a human oddity, but it was an oddity. Well, now that's almost the norm, you know. That's not as odd anymore. So I think and maybe there's been a change that we're more enlightened and we don't really, you know, want to profit off somebody. That's something that people had no, you know, they had no choice in the matter. This is how they are.
Right. And yet, yeah, people were profiting off of them, but it also gave them an opportunity to make a living that they might have had difficulty doing otherwise.
No question.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways in the world where that is the case in a way. It's where you're taking advantage of somebody, but if you don't take advantage of them in that way, they don't have a way to make a living. They don't have a way to survive. So it's, you know, you can try and make the world more fair so that they don't have to do that. It's you know, same with like when we started exporting manufacturing to other countries, that the people, you know, I felt like, well, we're kind of taking advantage of people there, paying them less.
Right.
But for those people, it was a step up from what they had been. It, you know, from the opportunities they had available to them before. So they didn't really see it as taking advantage. And is it a little bit the same with this?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, you could point to other examples where people, you know, want to be exposed, you know, I want to be taken advantage of because it produces, you know, a benefit to them in some other direction. So, you know, some of that can be good. Some of it can be not good at all.
Right, right. So you consider yourself a Southern writer, I assume.
Yes. Yes.
And were you born and raised in the South?
Yeah, I was. And I really lived here my whole life. My Michigan residence has come on later because my wife's family is from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan. And so we inherited my mother-in-law's house up there. And so we spend time up there now, which is, you know, a beautiful place.
Right, right. So it seems sometimes like Southern writers tend to go pretty dark. Would you agree with that, and if so, why?
Well, you know, I mean, it's hard to make generalizations because there's a lot of Southern writers, but you know, then a lot of them do different things. But I don't know. I mean, I guess it's, you know, again, if you're sort of embroiled in race and religion and things that are particularly going on here. Some of those things are darker things. And
right.
So if you really want to examine it and look at it, then it's it could be not necessarily a pretty thing.
So what is Southern Gothic exactly?
Well, it's a little bit of a nebulous term, but it, you know, if you Google it, and I have, because I've been asked this before, it sort of is a, you know, something that sort of tends towards the dark, actually, and that you know, deals with history and things that have sort of decayed over time, and you know, and that sort of thing. So I think that's sort of the general background is sort of in a, you know, darker and more decayed environment, if you will.
I feel like every Southern Gothic story has to have a swamp in it somewhere.
There's a little swamp in this, but not a lot.
Right, right. That's for sure. So, let's talk a little bit about your Word of South Literary Festival. What exactly is that?
Well, it is. It's a very unique festival that we started 11. This will be year 11. The festival is April, first weekend in April of this year. And it's every April. It sort of moves around some in April, depending on when Easter is. But it's a combination of books and music and authors and musicians. And we do all sorts of different and really fascinating stuff. And the way I got started was when The Gendarme was published, I got invited to speak at a number of literary festivals around the country. I'd never been to one. And I thought, man, we should do this in Tallahassee. But I was a city commissioner then. And I said, I need to get off the commission before we try this. So I did. I didn't run again. And I decided, you know, we'd go ahead and give this a go. And so we had accumulated money for several years. We had an awesome lineup the first year. And the festival was to be in this big public park that was brand new. We had all these tents and everything. And then it rained all weekend long. So stuff got canceled. We had to move around. You know, it was sort of a, you know, floating disaster. But there was enough there that we decided, this is kind of a cool thing. Why don't we keep it going? And there's really, Monica, nothing like it in the country. And so I get people, one of the most gratifying things, people come up to me every year, said, oh, I come down from Atlanta every year from this, or I drive up from South Florida. And we, you know, we've done some very unique and interesting things. I will be in the festival this year for the first time, and I'm going to be appearing with a keyboardist who's a fascinating guy who was a trained classical musician and decided at age 15 or 17 or something that he wanted to be the keyboardist for George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic, and he did. And so he's been their keyboardist for 20 years. So he and I are going to appear together, and we sort of have something worked out that I think will be fun and different.
So what makes this different than every other festival?
Well, but it's books and music combined. So if you're a musician who's written a memoir, we want you to come to Word of South. We have some almost every year. We pair authors and musicians, some of whom have never met. We did something a couple of years ago. We had the historian John Meacham appear with this African-American guitar phenom named Yasmin Williams. And it was fantastic. And they had met, you know, once on Zoom for like 10 minutes and then 10 minutes before we did it. And so it was, you know, so stuff like that. We did a big tribute to Nat and Cannonball Adderley, the musicians who are from Tallahassee. Members of their family came. That was a huge success. This year, the headliner for the festival is the Violent Femmes with the Tallahassee Symphony Orchestra, which should be fun.
Oh, wow. Speaking of musicians that wrote a memoir, we've got one here in Fairfield, Iowa, where I'm sitting right now, who recently wrote, I guess it's been out for a while, Jimmy Ryan. He was Carly Simon's guitarist.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, okay. And he wrote the Superstar Chronicles, Tales of Life Among Rock Royalty. And he does a presentation, like a combined music and talking, you know, about the stories and stuff. A great show that I've seen. So
we should have him down then.
Definitely,
We had Rita Coolidge a few years ago who had a memoir, you know, and there was stuff that came out of the memoir that it was getting like news headlines, you know, like she claimed, I would take her to word, that she wrote the coda to Layla, the Derek and the Dominoes song, which like, wow, really?
Wow.
So I never knew that. But anyway, it's been a lot of fun. I thought at the time I would be there for like 5 years and then I'm out of there, but 11 years in, I'm still there, and I'm proud of what we've done.
Well, that it does sound like a great time. Do you want to read a little bit from Boy with Wings?
Sure, I'd be glad to. And I've got a couple of, you can cut me off, Monica, if these are too long. I don't think they'll be. But the first is I wanted to read from sort of near the beginning of the book. And what happens, you know, is that Johnny, you know, his mother, you know, concocts this when he's born and he has these wings on his back. And suddenly the neighbors and people in this very rural area of Florida are kind of freaking out. And there's been some kids that have gotten sick and died, and they're blaming it on this weird kid with the back stuff. And so his mother concocts this scheme to that he died too. And she, you know, there's sort of, she had some circus ties and they had tried to pull that off. And so this particular part of the book is from her point of view after that happens. And she's in the house supposedly by herself, although really Johnny is hidden away there. So I'll read from that. A car purrs outside, its tires swishing like insects. Paul, I motion Jay to his cupboard, which he enters with a duck and frown. I think to freshen myself or at least brush my hair, but steps come with a knock that strikes a coldness inside me. Paul or Tom wouldn't stop and knock. I cough my way to the door, the floor tilting so that I must hang on the wall to stay upright, the grooves worn there, the root rot and stains. There's a space between boards we've stuffed with socks to block snakes. I peer out at a tall man, a stranger. I crack the door. What is it? The man holds a hat in one hand. The other hand, and his arm up to the shoulder, is gone, the light falling strangely around him, slanted somehow and made shiny bright. He's taller than me by at least a foot, thin mouth and staring like a bird looking past its beak. I think of the preacher, but this isn't a preacher, no collar or cross or speck of kindness to be seen. The preacher put his hands on me at the burial, my tears drained away then, my questions boiling up and unasked. What has God to be more than this love? Is a miracle to you one to me? Who is it that gauges sin? I hate preachers, you see. Hate them every one. You, Lena? I squint. I haven't seen him before, and I'd remember a man with what no arm. He isn't one of the neighbors. I don't open the door. May I come in? What do you want? The chill works to my spine, across to my chest. I draw back. I'm from Tallahassee. He smiles or tries to, but it comes off as hurtful. His eyes are as gray as a cat's. I'm a friend of your friend. He nods at the door again. Please? I make no move to open it. Friend. He pushes past, not rough, but quick enough to get by me, creaking the floorboards in the pitched and beaten shack. He spins around. I hear you got a son, Johnny. I'm unable to speak. Then, I did. I swallow, sniff. He's dead now. The man turns back, eyebrow raised. Huh, that's so? I'm struck dumb, unable to blink or to breathe. What if Jay makes a sound? He's done that before, and the walls here are so thin. He's only 6 years old, or seven. When did that happen? I sigh, a month back. My legs bend and I sway with it. What did he die of? Same thing I got. I cough to show him, long and with hills and bumps. He takes a step back then. He buried here? I nod. Tears form and fall in plops. I hear scuffling from the cupboard or twitching or breathing, and surely this man hears this too. I sniff the tears back. Where? Back at the church down the road, the graveyard. I'll stop by. His eyes take in the walls, the small room, the scuffed and bulging cupboard. He pushes the room's only door, his body slanted without the one arm, looks at the bed there, the clothes scattered. I'm sorry, he says, but he doesn't sound it. Another coughing spree spirals, long and with color. I notice a toy, a tiny train, left on the floor as if spun off its rails, misplaced there and glinting. The man seems to stare at it. You take care now, okay? I will. I shift and murmur, cough. I want to dance and wave my hands at him, distract from the rest. You know, he says, turning, we heard he was special. That's so? I look up at this man who wants to take something from me, something vital and heavy and much more than his missing arm. The thought comes to hurl punches or insults or slit his throat. Of course he was, special as the moon and stars. I should shout this up at him, flinging my anger through his nose into his brain, but instead my voice is soft, still and empty, cold. I would give up my life. He was my son. The car door slams, the motor snorts like a dragon, The tires swish again in the grass. My back heaves and tears slide down my throat. I cough brownish clots into a crumpled and gritty rag.
And that is from Boy with Wings. Yeah. Now, did you mention you had another section that you wanted to read as well?
This is a little shorter, if that's
sure.
Good. Monica,
of course,
So just to set the stage here. So this is after Johnny lands in this freak show. And it's the first night, they want him to go out there, and he's scared. He doesn't know what it really is asked of him. He's never done this before. And so I'm going to read from that part of the book. Get behind the curtain. They're coming in. And so they are, a shuffling line of rumpled men, 3 or 6 or 10 of them before he is pulled back from their view. Again, he is warm-faced, whirling once more when Tot's voice breaks and launches, amplified somehow like a god's. And here he is, gentlemen, that oddity from another land, that one of a kind, 1 in 10 million, born to an unknown mother, gift straight from the clouds. Please welcome the one and only Johnny C., the boy with wings. Muttering in a few hand claps, and he finds himself suddenly inside the tent, the cape on his shoulders and falling down his back. Maybe Sheila pushed him or Tata simply willed it, but he walks out as they told him, sitting and then striding from one end of the rail to the other, at first not looking, but then looking at each of them, one after one after one. He flourishes his cape, then turns his back to them and sits again in the chair. A murmur rises, different in tone from only minutes before this, a few words breaking. Where is some fraud? Back in Toledo. Again, Todd's voice squeaks. She's standing next to him somehow, peering and holding a small oil lamp. Now, the moment you've waited for, be prepared, as even grown men have been known to faint. She pauses. Don't tell your wives about this. Don't tell your children. Don't tell anyone. Another pause. He's a living, breathing monstrosity. Here he is, Johnny Cruel. He rises and, keeping his back to them, slowly drops the cape off his shoulders, exposing his side over the hump on his back. And with a rush, the cape falls, lying then twisted and shapeless on the ground just below. A hiss sounds behind him, new grunts and shifts. A few cries. What the? Can't be. Just putty, right? Sticking it on that boy. He stands there for a minute or two, tears dripping down his face, walks to one side and then the other before wrapping the cape over his shoulders, turning and striding past them and out. Sheila is behind the tent's wall, her eyes alive with excitement, their near fight forgotten, and he sees others watching, Zorat, Kenneth, Alfred, a few others unknown. One blonde-haired girl, a look of surprise or maybe confusion on her face, as if none of this makes even the slightest sense. He wipes at his eyes and walks on past them all. How'd it go? Sheila asks him. She's almost jumping up and down. His breath is calm. He squints up at the sky, the dried salt on his face cracking and his neck knit bent beneath this, fighting an impulse to laugh or to hug her. The stars form different shapes like white ink. He pulls the cape tight, feeling it catch on his wings, for isn't that what they are? Looking out at her now, he gestures outward and shrugs, turns his palms up, smiles. It was fine, I think.
And that's Mark Mustian reading from Boy with Wings. So, Mark, when did you decide you wanted to write novels?
Well, I'm different from a lot of writers. I didn't know at age 14 that this is what I wanted to do. I think probably came on as a early midlife crisis. I always wanted to be a lawyer, and I am a lawyer. But I remember about 10 years into practicing law, my law clients are scattered around the state of Florida. So I was, spent a lot of time by myself driving on I-10 and I-75. And I remember thinking, got to be more than this. And so I decided, I'd like to maybe try and do some other stuff. And I decided I'd like to maybe teach, like to maybe run for public office, and like to write a book. And eventually I did all of them. I taught for a couple of years at the local community college. That was enough to kind of cure me of wanting to do that.
But what did you teach?
I taught a course on the Constitution. And it was sort of, it was a required course. It would start with 100 students and end with 50. And, all the exams had to be graded at the same time within like a 3-day period. And I'm working full time. And, so I was like, maybe not here. And then in a fit of insanity, I ran for the city commission and was elected. And I was there for 10 years. And that was, I'm glad I did it and glad it's over. But back at the same time, I sat down and said, I want to write a book. And so I had, this naive assumption I could just sit down and do it. And and I saw later somebody refer to this as the equivalent of waking up one morning and saying, hey, I think I'll go practice thoracic surgery today. So I was very fortunate to get the book published. And I did get it. It was edited by a professional editor. And I had, that book was The Return. And so I had cause to look back at it and read it again a few years ago. And I was thinking, parts of this are pretty good, actually. And then parts are like, I hope I've improved some since then. But I discovered I liked doing it. And I at that time, my kids were really small. So the only time I could write was early in the morning. I'd get up before everybody else. I'd write for an hour. And then it's chaos from there on the rest of the day. So I felt like I had some talent and I just kept at it every day. And it's amazing what you can get done if you do it every single day. I meant my birthday, Christmas, I wrote, and still write. And I discovered, it felt like I had some talent and that it was time. It was an opportunity for me to be creative. It was a little bit of time to myself. And so I've continued on to this day.
Are you still writing an hour a day or are you able to write more now?
I still try and write an hour a day. I actually haven't been super lately because if you may know, Monica, the publicity involved for a book launch. So my book comes out Saturday. Is sort of all consuming, and that's so I haven't written as much as I wanted to lately. But yeah, I mean, up until last fall, middle of the fall, I was doing every hour a day, every day. I was polishing. I have another novel or two that I've worked on sort of in the interim, and so it helps me for whatever reason to sort of set those aside and then pick them back up again. And I see things then that I didn't see before, or it's just for whatever reason that works for me. So I'm going to pick those back up in the next few weeks, I hope.
So The Return was your first published book. Was that the first book you wrote or started?
It was.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
And but you've got these two that have been sort of that you've gone back and forth with in between the other books. Is that?
Yeah. So and I'm superstitious about talking about them. As soon as I do, people ask, well, what happened to the Revolutionary War novel? So, but I think they're both of them are worthy of publication. I mean, I've been around this long enough to know, I think, what is and isn't. And so I'm just trying to want to get my agent to weigh in on what she thinks would be the best book to try and go out with next. But they're both historical fiction. And I worked on both for quite a long time.
In Boy with Wings, did you start with just the character of Johnny, or did you start with kind of a overall plot?
It's a good question. So I had the general idea of doing something about a sideshow or a freak show. And I recall mentioning it to my agent at the time. And he had said, well, have you read this book, Geek Love? And I don't know, Monica, if you've ever read that. Way at the top of this particular genre and type of book. I mean, it's a really, I read it again recently, and it's as good as it was when I read it the first time. And it's similar in a fashion. It's about the sideshow and these parents intentionally take drugs to try and have malformed children.
Oh my gosh.
And then sort of what happens in the show. And so there's one character, one of the children, is just he becomes like a cult figure and but also like a megalomaniac. He's reminds me of our current president a little bit. And I was like, wow, this is really something. But I needed to do something, completely. I didn't want to, just redo what had been done there. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about it and sort of came up with the idea for Johnny, that somebody that was just completely different. And, how he reacts to that and tries to, fit in, but can't fit in. And so that's a little bit where it came from.
So the different characters that show up in Johnny's life, how did they show up to you?
Well, again, I don't know in terms of how they came into being. I'm not sure how they show up and how I tried to portray their their view of Johnny, because that's a lot of the way the book is structured. You learn about Johnny by what these other people are saying about him, and they see different things about him, and their reactions are different. Sheila sort of worships him to some degree. I think, the Zorat, who's the very religious guy that's on the show, initially he's enthralled with Johnny, and then he thinks he becomes not enthralled with him and fears him to some degree. And so I wanted to sort of give, different reactions, of the people that knew him and worked with him, sort of how they saw Johnny. And hopefully that informs you as a reader, this is, we're following Johnny's what's happening, but here's these other people talking about him, and you learn things that way.
So do you outline the story ahead of time, or do you discover what happens next as you're writing?
I've done it every different way, and different books. I mean, for the Return, I just sat down and wrote the first half of the book. And then after that, I said, well, maybe I need to outline this to figure out how we get to the end. And in the Gendarme, I sort of knew how I wanted the beginning and the end to be. And so I sort of, then went back and sort of figured it out from there. With Boy with Wings, it's sort of different altogether. I had the idea for Johnny, and so I sort of had to chart his, path a little bit. And then I sort of built around that with other people, like I say, and their reactions to him as a character.
Okay. And did you know how it was going to end?
Yeah, I generally have to know sort of, it doesn't work for me to just, I figured out the ending when I get there. I generally know how I want it to end. Now, how we get there is a whole different story, and that can change the characters. I've had characters where I go, they wouldn't really, I had outlined something, so they wouldn't really do that. We got to change this. But I generally know how I want it to end.
Okay. Does that ever change? Have you started writing a book, you thought it was going to end here, and then you ended somewhere completely different?
Yes. It's shifted. I wouldn't say it's 100%, gone in a different direction. So like for the Gendarme, this is a much longer story than you want to hear, but I had changed that book. I didn't have an agent at the beginning of that. And so I'm trying to get an agent. And a friend of mine who's a writer referred me to his agent, and the guy read the manuscript and called me. He goes, "Well, hey, I was only going to read 15 pages of this, but I wound up reading the whole thing."
And he said, that's a good sign.
Yeah. And he said, and that had a current day and a historical part. He said, the historical part of your book is awesome. He said, the current day part, you got to change the whole thing. So I was like, oh my God, I worked on this for years, but I did. So I went back and changed it all. And it's 9 months later, I get, I've got this, revised manuscript, send it to him, no word. Then finally he says, "Well, I'm just not excited about it enough to take it on." But I kept that version of the book because I liked it. And that it involved changing the ending a little bit because, the whole structure was different. And so, it wasn't radically different ending, but it was, but Boy with Wings, same thing. I had it ending a certain way, not far from where it is now. And then something came to me and I thought about, this would be a little bit better. And so I changed it, shifted it just a little bit at the end.
Okay. Now, do you write the book in order? Like, did you write the chapters in the order that they ended up being in the finished version?
I generally do. I know some people don't. I did. Now, after I did a first draft, I tried to go back, and there's so many revisions and rewrites, but I tried to go back then and just look at each character. Let me look at everything that's from Johnny's point of view. I'm going to go back and look at this character's point of view and just make sure the voice is different, so it's not all sounding the same. And so that was sort of the way I did it with Boy with Wings.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you did not have an agent when you were trying to, get your second novel out. Right. So how did what was the path to publication on the first novel?
Well, the first novel, I ended up getting an agent on the second novel, and that's how it got published. But the first novel, I did not have one. And so it was published by a regional press in Florida. And I had a friend who was a lawyer also who had a book published by them. And I said, "Hey, would you mention me to them?" And he did. And I sent them a manuscript. And I still remember I'm sitting in my law office and this woman calls who's the publisher there. She says, "Well, Mark, we got your manuscript." She said, "Would you like us to publish it?" I'm like, "Well, that's why I sent it to you." I did get an agent finally, the old fashioned way for the Gendarme. I was about on agent query number 80 when I got my agent, who was great. And he could get the book in front of people that could make decisions. And that's how it happened. With Boy with Wings, I have a new agent who I like a lot. And same thing. She was able, I had not heard of this particular publisher. She said, "I've heard good things. Let's go give it a try." And that's how it came about.
So each book was with a different publisher.
Yes.
And all kind of independent presses?
No, the Gendarme was published by Putnam, which is Penguin. That's one of the big five now, whatever. The first book was a regional press that's still around. They were bought out eventually. It was a husband and wife operation when I did it. And then Penguin, and then the new book is an independent press that they do traditional publishing formats, and that's what this is. So, and I'm very pleased with the quality of the book and with them. They've been great.
So with the return, with your first book, was that the first publisher you sent it to that said, and they said yes?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah. I mean, I sent it to a whole bunch of agents, and yeah. They all said no. But they were, that was the only publisher I sent it to. So the longer story on that was, So I finally did have an agent that responded to me on the first book. It seemed to be, pretty reputable. And so she said, because you send sample chapters or, whatever. And she said, she says, you definitely can write. But she says, in my experience, you need what all first-time authors do. You need to, work with an independent editor. And I want to refer you to one. I said, okay, fine. And I asked the agent, said, do you think this is salvageable or should I just start over on something else? She said, I think you should start over on something else. I'm like, okay. So I get it to the editor and I'd signed the contract at this point to do it with the regional press. So I said, I'm going to just let the editor look at it. Maybe she may have some feedback and everything. So I get the manuscript back from her. This is in the days of physical copies. And so the beginning of the book, she's got all these comments and blah, blah, blah. By the end, there's almost none. And so she calls me and says, hey, I had no idea this was this good. She says, you need to get out of the contract with the regional press and take this to New York. I said, well, I've signed the contract with the regional press. That's what we're doing. So anyway, but it was some validation that, she liked it. So that was, and then when I got my agent for the gendarme, that was a nice little story too. So we had missed each other and I'd sent the manuscript and I'd sort of gotten, I guess, via email that he liked it. And so I was at a cocktail party and the phone rings, it's a New York number. So I step outside and I said, well, hey, I understand you like the book. He said, no, Mark, I love the book. And I'm thinking, boy, I've waited a long time to hear that. So anyway, that was, that worked out well.
Wow. So why did you not stick with Putnam for Boy with Wings?
I would have if they had wanted to. My editor had left by then, and she was with another publishing house. And we pitched it to Putnam. But I don't, sometimes, When the editor leaves, there's less interest after that. So
yeah, you become orphaned, basically.
Exactly.
Right. Well, do you have any words of advice for wannabe writers?
I do. I've been encouraged for years to write a blog, which I've resisted, but I'm doing one now. And so if you go on my website, which is markmustian.com, the very first blog post is advice for writers. And I'll paraphrase some of it here that, the first thing is to read. It sounds simple and silly, but hey, read and read good stuff and read more. And then some of it sort of comes second nature at that point.
Yeah.
So that's probably the number one advice. The second is, I had to go do an interview at another city. And so I stopped eating lunch. I'm sitting at the bar ordering food. And the guy sits down next to me. We get to talking. And, this is a very common, I was telling him, well, I'm a writer. I was just here to do the film, this TV show, the interview. And he says, oh, yeah, well, I've got about half a book written. I'm like, I had a dollar for every time I've heard that. And so I said, well, that then the thing to do is finish it. Sit
down,
knock it out. And then you can work at it. It's always the hardest thing for me as a writer is to get the first words down. I can edit anything, but getting it down to begin with is the toughest thing.
I agree. Well, Mark, thank you for being with us today. We're out of time. We always close with a quote, and I found from Dr. Seuss, we are all a little weird and life's a little weird. And when we find someone whose weirdness is compatible with ours, we join up with them and fall in mutual weirdness and call it love. from Dr. Seuss.
Perfect quote. Thanks, Monica.
You're very welcome. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.